Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Welcome to MacBreak Weekly, episode 576 for September 19th, 2017, Throwing the Horns.
MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million people. Try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. And by Capterra. Find software solutions for your business needs. Capterra is a free website with over 400 categories of business software and thousands of ratings and reviews from software users just like you. Visit Capterra.com/MacBreak today. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code MacBreak to save 20% off any order.
It's time for MacBreak Weekly. I'm Renee Ritchie doing my absolute worst Leo Laporte imitation. But better news, we have Andy Inotko with us from the Chicago Sun-Times. How are you, Andy?
Hello, Renee.
You cost me a fortune in two damn dollar comics yesterday, sir.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have to offset. Amazon's having this huge, incredible sale on Marvel collected comics and trade paperbacks, and it's the prices are so $20 trade paperbacks that are digital down to $2 in some sense. It's like when you go to a yard sale in October and you realize that someone who just went off to college, their mother is just saying, "Oh, look at all these boxes of all these old comics. Do we just cluttering around the room in the garage? Well, I'll just get rid of them for, I don't know, $10 a box." And you're you feel guilty for spending so little money for so much, but then you doesn't prevent you from buying about 20 graphic novels. So yes, that's my problem.
I spent one Alex Lindsay on those. And speaking of Alex Lindsay, joining us from, I don't think it's parts unknown, I think it's parts European, Alex himself. How are you, Alex?
Hi, from I'm in Brussels. Nice. I was in Amsterdam this morning, but came down to see some friends down here, and I'm at a place called Alice Productions. They do a ton of the video for a lot of the broadcasters here and the EU, and the EU is actually right over there. so anyway, but I definitely want to thank Alice Productions for allowing me to use up one of their conference rooms for this.
Do you have beer, chocolate, or waffles with you? And I just alienated the entire audience. I'm sorry.
I have had all of those things in the last 24 hours. It turns out that I'm in the right place. I will admit that I'm trying to lose weight, but doing it in Amsterdam and Brussels is very difficult. Hard.
Well, I could talk about Belgium and comic books with you gentlemen for hours, literally. But we have an Apple event to recapitulate. You guys did an amazing job covering it last week. I was there, so I can talk to you about the facilities if you're curious about what the bathrooms look like in the Steve Jobs Theater. I mean,
that is what everyone wants to know.
Yeah.
How are the bathrooms in the Steve Jobs Theater? I bet you they are. Every bit of detail.
First question I think that about the bathrooms would be, how do you dry your hands? Either they're going to say you're going to get one of those really horrible institutional brown corrugated paper pull down dispensers, or they're going to say no, you're going to get those wonderful things that are like lens cloths that are in a little pile by the sink, or they're going to say no, we're all hippie friendly, you only get one of those Dyson wind blade things that makes you do an incantation over a fire for 10 minutes to get your hands moderately dry. So how do you dry your hands at the Steve Jobs Theater?
There is a towel dispenser right near the exit. So you just pull out the paper towel from underneath it, dry your hands, and put it in the receptacle that's located immediately underneath the towel dispenser. So you never have an urge to throw it on the floor. I got to try two, though. There was facilities at the parking lot where we all went in, and then there was also in the visitor's center, and they have these enormous ceiling to floor wooden doors in front of the cabinets. I don't know what the right word for this, the small rooms, the vestibules that you close completely. And then they have a couple, I'm assuming Johnny and I have designed urinals, and then they have the sinks. Not everything looked 100% finished. It looked like they really rushed to get those things up and operational. And if I could, I would be filing radars with the facility facilities team if they let outsiders do that. But it was super interesting. It was interesting configuration because Infinite Loop is so small. You go to Infinite Loop, you go around a little bit, you're at Town Hall, and you're basically doing this. But here you come down Tantau Street, and you go to the visitor center, and you go in there, and then you walk up, and they have a very unique cafe, a unique Cafe Max, and that just mostly looks like a coffee bar, not a full-on cafeteria. And on the other side of that is Apple Store, Apple Park, and they're sort of fused into one building. And you can walk upstairs and get a terraced view of the entire campus. And then you have to walk over some rolling hills to get to the Steve Jobs Theater. And it's almost Japanese in that sometimes you don't see Apple Park, the big loop, at all. And other times you turn around a corner and then suddenly this immense, it looks like suborbital structure is just blotting out part of your field of view. But it's a lot more exercise than the previous campus was.
At some point, is there somebody in a polo shirt whispering in your ear as you walk, "Remember, thou art mortal. Remember, thou art mortal. Remember, thou art mortal."
Every 3 feet, because it rained. It rains every time I go to Cupertino. I don't know what it is, but it rained and the tiles were a little slick. So they had, I believe it's Apple retail staff who mans a lot of these events. And about every 3 feet, there was someone greeting you and making sure you successfully made it to the next 3 feet.
Now, is the Cafe Max and the Apple Store, are those open to the public? So if someone wants to make a pilgrimage to the mothership, there is a place where they could just simply park the car, go in, buy a t-shirt, buy a cup of coffee?
They will be. They're not open yet. They did a sort of a faux opening just for people who were there at the event. And that included Apple people who were lining up for stuff because they had t-shirts for Apple Park and, playing cards. They took the stuff from the Apple design book and they had postcard versions of that. And they had a few other things. They had the biggest news for me, the biggest product, the one that got the least attention, was the return of the Apple onesies, which we haven't seen since the old Infinite Loop store.
Yeah, I saw your Instagram where your family members are now being appropriately imprinted at an early age, huh?
There were no Alex-sized onesies. I did check.
Dang, I know.
And still no hoodies. Expect to behave your hoodies.
If I could get like put every morning put on my a clean t-shirt and clean underwear with just like one garment, that could save me some time.
Especially a beautifully engineered Apple aluminium garment. But I mean, the place was gorgeous. It looks like the latest, like the Apple Union Square Apple Store, the World Trade Center Apple Store. It's very much in that austere aesthetic with the woods and a lot of nature. They have a lot of nature both inside and outside. And the Steve Jobs Theater is incredibly impressive because there is no structure inside it. It's this giant a round glass building with not a single pillar or column inside. All there is this roof on top of you. And you sort of look up every once in a while to make sure the roof is still above you. It's a very strange feeling, just so big and open.
Yeah, that seems like basically overall, this feels like another Apple product.
Totally, 100% an Apple product. And they had, I'm sure you guys discussed it during the event, but this was sort of like Steve Jobs' final public product. And this was his theater and named after him. And it was architected in a way that there's no trick missed here. Like, we didn't get to use it because it wasn't online yet. But the elevator, when you go down in the Steve Jobs Theater, you don't go in one side and come out the other. The elevator apparently actually turns as you're going down so that you only have to worry about one exit and one entrance. And when you sit down, it just looks like a normal place. But then these pod bay doors close with what I think is a sweetened sound of like ching-ching when they actually finish. And then when they open up again, the entire demo area is there as though someone pulled a cloth off and it was just all the products. A lot of stagecraft.
Was it nice and comfy? You were there for a while sitting in those seats. I hear the seats they spent, no expense spared on the chairs.
They were very square. They're leather. The rumor was they spent thousands of dollars on them. If you followed the armrest down, you got to a little power outlet. And they were comfy. And there's no bad view. There's no bad view in the house. You had two. There is no middle row. There's like two. There's left middle, right middle, and then two side rows. And they all face in towards the stage. And the acoustics, I don't know any of this stuff, Alex. I need you to infiltrate and get all the actual details. But apparently the acoustics are the same no matter where you're sitting. They modeled it after some of the big theaters in San Francisco where you can hear the same regardless of where you're sitting. And then they had, I believe it was two Dolby Vision projectors in full HDR. And I'm guessing they had Dolby engineers sitting on top of them, calibrating them by the second to make sure that everything looked perfect for the entire show.
And did it look perfect for the entire show?
People said it was, for that 2 hours, it was the best theater in the world, the best calibrated theater in the world. I don't doubt it.
I know, probably 4K at the maximum, you know, perfect brightness, HDR. Yeah, I don't think it's going to get any better than that.
P3, so you get, like, that's the thing is, like, the 4K stuff is really interesting, but when you get P3 for the much wider range of colors, and then you get HDR for the much wider range of luminance, when Eddie Q took the stage and he started showing you the difference, and he said, you know, we got this projector so you could actually see the difference, you can actually see the difference. It's like, it's almost like colors you never see before. Like, someone brought a squeegee out and cleaned off the glass you've been looking through, and everything loses a layer of gray and just looks very bright all of a sudden.
Now, how about things like, let's talk about amenities and stress items for people who have to attend events there. So the two things that have always sort of bothered me about Apple events: one doesn't matter, one kind of matters. What doesn't matter is the food has always been very much, I suppose legally we have to give you water because we're making you wait for an hour and a half. And there's always been so many, even on the Apple campus, like choke points where it's like, okay, I'm standing within 8 inches of every other human who is at this event while I'm waiting for the demo area or waiting for the doors to open. Like, have they improved either of those two things?
The food was good. I think the food for the last couple events has been good. And they have, like, vegan food now, as well as food with, like, chicken and beef. And they had sandwiches both at the – before the event and then in the Mac, the Cafe Max. I don't know if they actually call it that, but whatever the cafeteria is called at the visitor center. And both of it was pretty good. They had those apple fruit drinks. I forget which one. Like a carrot power drink and a beet power drink. And that was all good. And those were in tables. Originally, they were in tables surrounding the Steve Jobs Theater. So you could walk around, sort of take in the view, and then – munch as you wanted, and people did glom on them immediately because reporters don't eat. They're very poor, as all of us know, and you want to get as much free Apple food as you can. I'm partially joking, so they were all on those very quickly to get the coffee and the beverages and stuff. And then it sort of, they spread out and people wanted to photograph, walk around and sort of photograph the Apple buildings as much as they could.
So were they controlling security as to making sure that people don't wander off and get pictures or look at things they're not supposed to look at?
It's so far away. Like when you, the building is so big, so it makes it look like it's close, but it's probably a 10 or 15 minute. It was like a minute walk just to get to the broadcast platform. You had to go around two paths and then up to get to the broadcast platform. And then it must've been a 10, 15 minute walk. I'm guessing, cause I didn't get a chance to try it, but it's a bit of a walk to get to the Steve Jobs Theater, then a bit of a walk to get to the actual campus. So I don't know that there are stun gun snipers sitting on top ring of that building. I don't think you'd get very far because there's very little cover still.
So it's more like Disney World, where yes, there are people who can take you out if you start to act funny, but they're meant to be invisible as they do so. You won't even see the red dot before you're tranked.
They were very happy, very nice, and there was a big no drones. This is a no drone area sign when we walked in.
So I didn't get a chance to deploy. What would you say to people that are that may be coming to, like, the Bay Area, or maybe coming to San Jose in January, February, or March? Like, do you think it's going to be easy to get to the visitor center? Like, where would it be like a detour for a visitor, or would it be a destination where it's open to the public. Yes, you can definitely get a coffee there and get a t-shirt there, but it's so much trouble to get there and to get to the visitor center that maybe you want to plan a lot of time for it and budget for it.
Yeah, so I'm guessing it'll be similar to Infinite Loop. I just don't know what the traffic is going to be like yet because they had a lot of the roads closed for the event, and they were very careful about directing everything. But when you have thousands and thousands of Apple employees trying to get in and out, and everyone else who works in the area trying to get in and out, and Bay Area traffic being what it is, I mean, I would try to go there off hours, and then enjoy your coffee, enjoy your t-shirt, sort of take your photos, and then get out before the traffic starts again.
One thing that I always tell people about Infinite Loop is that, yes, it's an Apple store. Yes, anybody can go there. But realize that there are burly men in black polo shirts who are definitely know that you're there, who have a mental stopwatch going. And if you take more than 12 seconds to take that selfie, you will be spoken to and advise that how long will sir be or madam be standing in front of this building taking pictures of the sign, and make sure that you don't take pictures of anything that has two legs on it. Like, okay.
Yeah, no, I think they've built this sufficiently far from where the actual business gets taken place that you'll have a good time. I don't know if there'll be that much to interest you after you bought your t-shirt and beverage holder, but it's a nice place to visit, and people want to make the pilgrimage, Andy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, The other part that was interesting is the demo area, because those are always different, because Apple usually has them in a wide range of venues. Like at the old town hall, it was in the piano bar. And when they had it at some of the bigger, you know, like Yerba Buena or the Flint Center, they would convert part of the facilities into the demo area. This year, they got to build their own. And that's kind of cool, because we've heard these stories about like a $1 million podium that they only use once, that sort of brings a thing up and turns it around and shows it off to you. And this demo area, they had to assemble it, I'm guessing, while we were watching the show. So it couldn't be overly complicated, but it was still, it filled sort of, there were round tables and they had iPhone 8 on some of the tables and Apple Watch 3 on some of the tables and iPhone 10 sort of strategically placed in between. And I think that was a balancing act for them, because if you had too many iPhone 10s, nobody would have looked at anything else. But if you didn't have enough, you ended up having, you know, people waiting for a long time to get their hands on an iPhone 10. So I'm interested to see how they sort of adjust that going forward.
And so was there really much interest in the 8, or was it pretty much everyone just waiting to play with the 10?
There were people glomming around the 10, realizing it would be a while, and then sort of moving out to look at the 8 in the meantime.
That sounds like that's how the order process is going as well.
did they have enough demo units out there?
No, I would say no. Like, I think in their view, they did, because they didn't want that to take all the attention. But you know, after a while, you're looking at your watch and you're wondering if David Poe is going to start singing anytime soon, so you can get your turn.
And what about I also wanted to know if the iPhone X's that they had out there, were they functional, or were they, it's you know how like the first iPhone, the only like a dozen people got to actually handle the demo ones backstage afterward. And the ones that are out in public were in a tube that you could not get through. So you couldn't see what was working and what was like the bomb icon.
No, we got to use them. I mean, Serenity got to be a space alien. I got to be a poo emoji. We got to try out the true depth camera to take selfies. And it's kind of wild seeing a single camera delivering an image that you expect to see off the old dual camera system. And we got to try out the swipe to go up. We couldn't try Face ID, because Face ID is locked to only one person. You can't have multiple Face IDs. Well, you can Touch IDs, and it was locked to the Apple representative who had the phone. But they would do, like, they were very, I want to say, like, means their job, but they were still very patient. People were like telling them, like a dancing monkey, unlock it again, unlock it again, unlock it again, spin around and unlock it again. And it was working really fast for them. They did a whole range of demos, from just like the basic unlock to what if this. And it's got two modes. It's got the regular mode, which has attention enabled, which means that it has to see you looking at it. Like it knows that you want to look at it, so that it doesn't make any mistake and unlock when it just happens to glance at your face. But if for any reason you want to turn that off, so if, for example, for accessibility reasons, if you're a low or no sight, you can turn it off. Then all it has to do is see sort of from your eyes down to your mouth area from any angle, and it'll open. Which is better for convenience, but worse for security. So we got to see some of the demos of that stuff. And Face ID, it's also possible that after the event, people at Apple were less relaxed, were less concerned about using it when they were out and about. And if you were at a coffee shop, you could see people come up and very quickly use Apple Pay off those devices. And it was very quick every time. So I'm a little bit less concerned about Face ID than I was last week.
Did the demonstrator people try to like trick Face ID by like putting on sunglasses, taking them off, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so it was amazing to hear them talk about it, because it was kind of scary too, because they talked about it like they were training a pet, not like it was a computer. Because they were saying, like, we did like a billion photos, and we trained it. We got people in Hollywood to make masks and to make prosthetics, and we made 3D video and tried to hold it at the right direction. And it's not like they programmed it. It's like it's like literally machine learning, Tinder for computers. Yes, yes, no, 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 yes, yes. Good Face ID, good Face ID. No, 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 bad Face ID, bad Face ID. And it trained it, and it got better and better. So it can see through a lot of sunglasses. If the sunglasses are IR filtered, if it blocks infrared light, which I think some high-end beach sunglasses do, then it can't see through them. They're utterly opaque to them. But as long as they're regular sunglasses, polarized or not, as long as they don't block IR, they're just like regular glasses. They can go right through them. And that's sort of the whole thing. Like, it's got to get enough points to work. So if you're wearing like a Canadian balaclava with your ski goggles or a ninja mask, it probably won't work. But if you're wearing like a hat, a scarf, if your facial hair changes, it can mostly adapt to all of those things.
Wow.
And it adapts, which is crazy.
that's the thing that was I'm really keen to see. I know that they said during the presentation that, hey, this is whereas Touch ID, a random fingerprint, has a 1 in 35,000 chance of unlocking your phone. With Face ID, it's 1 in a million. But I'm not even talking about like brothers and sisters or identical twins. Like anybody who works in a large office for more than 4 years at one point has said, do you know, there's a guy in accounting who looks so much like three times I almost came up to him and said, hey, Josh, and it would turn out to be Carl. And what if Carl, like who's a known Weisenheimer, is passing by your cubicle and sees that you've left your iPhone out charging, say, yeah, I wonder if my face will unlock it. And I'm curious to see if Face ID is smart enough to know the difference between Carl and Josh, or will it think, oh, I guess Josh just suddenly sprouted a mustache in the past 3 hours. Okay, well, I will learn a mustache.
There was a we talk about 30,000 for the fingerprint, and we talk about 1 million for the face. There was a time when like Ford cars, you know, had a very small number of different keys, much smaller than 30,000. And the reason I know that is because I have gotten into the wrong Ford Explorer, like literally was like looking around. I saw a Ford Explorer, same color. I went in, I turned the key, I got in there. I was like, this is not my car. You know, and it was just like, and that's when I did a little research and I was like, there's not that many keys, you know, for the things. When we think about security, I mean, the level of security that we're getting now is so much higher than, you know, many other things that we've had, you know, in the past, whether, you know, it's been a long progression.
Yeah. And they said like if you had an evil twin, that would be more problematic, but it seems like it's pretty good. And they've done all sorts of tests to try to prove it. Oh, well, a good twin, I mean, then
would never do that. Would never try to open your phone. Would never do that to your phone, is try to open it, I think.
If you have an evil twin, you have bigger problems than what happens with your new phone's unlocking.
Well, they have a goatee and that button that destroys people like Spock had. So you have a lot of different, or maybe Spock had Face ID for that. But they did. They tested it in a wide variety of circumstances. And it sounds like the biggest drawbacks are, again, it's one face as opposed to five fingers. So it's if you're used to sharing it with a spouse or a partner or an employee or someone, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. Also, for people who just have facial, you know, facial dysmorphia, or just don't want, there's some people who just don't like the idea of a machine scanning their face, and they just will not be comfortable with this. And there's very little they can do about that except for, you know, kindly suggest a different phone to them. And then there are people who just will have to learn new use cases. So if you're used to using Apple Pay by clicking twice on the home button, then tapping the terminal, all you'll do is click twice on the side button and tap the terminal. It's just as fast. If you're used to tapping the terminal first, then putting your finger on Touch ID, with this, you touch the terminal and then have to bring it back to your face, which is a slower process. So there'll be a little bit of a tuning into it. But other than that, it seems like it's a comparable, if not slightly faster system. But again, I only got a chance to see people using it. I have to try it. We all have to try it ourselves.
And I know you didn't. I'm guessing you have not been assigned a loaner piece of hardware yet. But if you have, pretend that you haven't. So how do you imagine that? Like, it's, I mean, at this point, the home button is such a basic part of the vocabulary of the iPhone. If you've been using it since day one, like, is there anything that's kind of off-putting to you about not having a home button, like a function that hasn't been remapped to something else really well? How quickly do you think it's going to take for you to get used to not having a home button?
I've heard from people who have been using it for a while that it took less than a day, and then it's just swipe up is such a natural gesture, and many of us remember it from WebOS anyway, that you just swipe up and it feels totally normal. And they did have to remap stuff like the accessibility shortcut, the Apple Pay shortcut, all of that is on the side button. Control Center is now at the top right, because there would be too much gesture collision if they left it at the bottom. So there's a couple concessions there, but swiping up, it just feels really natural, and it feels like it feels like I'm back on WebOS, Andy. It's the best way I could say it. It's like, I actually really like that gesture.
Yeah, I'm glad that you had a week, because I assume that by now, after physical therapy and emotional therapy, your eyes and your psyche have healed from the experience of having to look at an iPhone screen with a black notch at the top. I hope I haven't triggered you, because I know is a really emotionally devastating thing for so many people, that there is a notch at the top of the screen. Now, you're in a place of peace and love. Nothing will happen here that you do not want to happen. So you're completely in control. But if you can possibly walk us through the harrowing experience of using an iPhone that has a black notch at the top of the screen, we love
it. My experience is not a normal one, because you're so excited when there's a brand new product that just like that excitement level lets you tolerate a lot of things that in the day-to-day average use you may not. So I saw them. I could not unsee it. I call it the horns. I like that term because Craig Federighi is really good at flashing those. Some people call it the forehead and the ears, whatever floats your boat. I can't unsee it. Like I did notice it, especially when I turned it landscape. You can shrink down things. Like if you fill the screen with a movie, like I filmed it with Wonder Woman. And at first I'm like, holy hell, this is the world's first real HDR device. HDR from color management all the way to screen. This is blowing my eyeballs out. But then I'm like, what's this thing on the left? So you can't not see it. When it's in portrait mode, it does sort of fade away. But when it's in landscape and you see it sort of encroaching on apps and the apps have to be extra padded to go on the side, then you absolutely do notice it. Will I notice it a week after using it? I think so. I think that's the sort of thing that I'm just – like there's different kinds of people. Some people could care less. I think I'm the kind of person that it will always bother me. I would love to be proven wrong by that, but I just think, Andy, I'm not going to get over it. I'll put up with it, but I won't get over it.
Over Macho Grande? Well, never. I'm never over Macho Grande. But doesn't when watching video, doesn't it like black out the when you go full screen? Doesn't it like accommodate it somehow? Like
full
black
screen,
out
you see the notch. Background? Full screen, it goes around the notch. When you fill up the display, like when you tap on it, you make everything big, so it fills up the display. Then the notches or the horns are really apparent. When you shrink it back down, not so much. Like it sort of goes end to end the way you'd expect.
Yeah, I saw some developers were posting on Twitter after Apple posted user interface guidelines for developers on how to embrace the notch, so to speak. But it came up with the mock-ups of how I had a hard time not having seen the iPhone X in person yet. I had a hard time thinking that was going to be that big a deal. Maybe part of it is that I am a veteran of the Moto 360 watch, you know, that has the infamous flat tire at the bottom. But that had that little archway at the bottom for the same reason why the notches on the iPhone, because both the watch and the phone, they wanted to have no bezel whatsoever. And the cost of no bezel is you still have to put a sensor somewhere that's not being covered up by the screen. And I found that it would have been better to not have it there, but I kind of ignored it after about the first half a day or something. But
did it
seemed
bother
to me
you if
like,
you had to turn it sideways half the time? Like if it was at the bottom half the time and sideways half the time?
I mean, it's like, and with some of these mockups, it just seemed like, well, what if Apple, between now and November, when they ship this thing, they just added a system preference that says just make the status bar black all the time, in which case, partly because this is an OLED screen, it will just simply look like your same black status bar, only now you don't have something in the middle of it. You have things to the left and the right of it. I'd be more concerned if it were something that really affected like the day-to-day use of it. And I have a hard time seeing the notch as something that can't be adjusted with a software update later on, or something that I won't kind of get used to. So I mean,
I'm pretty sure they internally they've had this for a long time and they've tried everything. Yeah. They've hidden the notch. They've embraced the notch. They've done variants of the notch. They've done sometimes notch, sometimes no notch. And again, I think that they just made a decision. And I don't know if it was a marketing decision. Marco Armand had a really good article yesterday saying that it allows Apple to have an iconic shape again because the home button is gone. And now you when they make that sort of icon or that glyph showing the iPhone, it's unmistakable. It doesn't look like an Android phone. It doesn't look like a generic phone. It looks like you tell immediately, oh, horns, it's an iPhone. And I don't know if marketing is the right place to make that decision.
Yeah, I don't know about attaching horns to the iPhone is necessarily a great marketing decision. That's all I'm saying. You know,
also the Essential phone also has a notch, so it does look like another phone.
Yeah. But again, like they, anytime you see a design on Twitter or anywhere else, Apple's engineers have done 20 variations of that and decided whether it's because of other issues or because of personal taste that they didn't want to go with that. Some people have said maybe that it would affect burn-in, but like Samsung has shown, you can, shake the interface slightly, like wiggle it so that the pixels change and you don't burn them in. So there's always workarounds for all these things. I think ultimately it's just that they decided they wanted to embrace the horns.
Yeah, I mean, if Apple wants to do something that's design-wise, it's not as though they don't care about usability, but that's not a third rail to them. We will take some heat from this, but people are not going to buy an iPhone X because of the notch. And if they aren't going to buy it because of the notch, they would have gotten upset about something else. So we can't really make everybody happy.
But one thing I'm super curious about is the display, because the display is OLED. It's a Samsung panel, and no one ever called it Pentile because I think that's a Samsung trademark. But it is a diamond RGBB whatever, a 5 pixel arrangement instead of the standard RGB that we're all used to. I couldn't see. I looked. looked at it. I did not have my loop with me, so I couldn't. I didn't have a macro with me, so I couldn't really get in there and look at it. But I couldn't tell to the naked eye. And again, that might be the excitement of just seeing HDR Wonder Woman on a phone for the first time. apparently, Apple's also doing a lot of things. Like it's not that they bought the screen from Samsung and it's going to be identical to the screen you get on a Galaxy S8. Might be better, might be worse, but it's like, you know, Samsung manufactures their chips, but their chips are unique to Apple, and other people manufacture other components, but they're unique to Apple. And Apple sandwiched this together and did a lot of stuff from the subpixel to the color management to the True Tone to everything to sort of make this their version of OLED. And that's sort of the thing I'm most curious about is to figure out what Apple Display Team managed to do with OLED.
Mm. Now, what about the rest of the phone overall? Does it feel like a deluxe product compared to the iPhone 8, or does it just feel like a different design, like the difference between like the ceramic watch edition versus the regular aluminum one? It really does feel like a premium version of that other one. Is you get that sort of effect with the iPhone X?
The stainless steel feels better. Like it just feels better than the aluminum. That's probably a personal thing. And the black one has a vapor treatment, which is sort of like DLC. I don't know the chemistry exactly, but it's sort of like DLC on the black Apple Watch. So it feels harder, but also it just has a different feeling to it. The black ones always feel like some sort of weird kryptonite or Batman material to me. They don't feel like a natural material. They kind of look a bit like plastic, but feel like steel. And it's really grippy because it's a small phone. It's about the size of an iPhone 4.7. inch iPhone, but then your eyes are filled with that screen, and it was impossible for me, at least in the demo area, to separate the experience of seeing it from holding it. So that sort of colored my judgment. But the back is plastic, but on the black version, especially the space gray version, it's almost seamless with the antenna band. It's a very stark difference. It's a shiny silver with like a pearl white on the silver version, but the space gray version is black on black, and that I really like both the look and feel of that one.
What's the back made out of?
The back is glass because it does the inductive charging same way.
I thought you said plastic. I said, no, I didn't.
I did not feel it correctly. Yeah, no, it's like the DLC coating. The black Apple Watch does not feel like metal. It feels like a weird space material. And this sort of has a little bit of that same feeling. And it's matte. And like, well, the silver one is super shiny and the black one is not quite as shiny. I mean, it's just, they did a good job, that materials team.
Awesome.
Should we kick it over to Uncle Leo for a couple of minutes so he can tell us about something wonderful before I just go on and on and on?
See, that this is the price when you're the only one who gets to see the Apple campus and you're the only one who gets to see the iPhone 10. You are the interview subject as much as you are the host, at least until we change something else.
Absolutely. Well, Carson, if we have it ready, can Leo tell us about something great?
Let me interrupt for just a moment. Yeah, I'm here. I'm back. Well, not really, but I'm here anyway to tell you about FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes running your business easy, fast, and secure. With FreshBooks' all-new version of their cloud accounting software, you'll never be at mystery as to how you're doing. Let me tell you, I know about FreshBooks because I used FreshBooks for years when I was a freelancer. And this was a while ago. FreshBooks started in, I think, 2004. That's when I started using them anyway. Since then, 10 million people have used them, including me. The first thing I did was use them to do invoices because it made it so much easier. It was a very painful task every month to send out those invoices, and I was billing for expenses, so I put the expenses together. If you're doing hours, even more complicated. FreshBooks takes all the pain out of it. Use the FreshBooks app. You take a picture of the receipt. Boom! It goes right in the invoice. You bill for time and hours, or bill per project, or per team, or per client. You can do all of that with the FreshBooks software or on the FreshBooks website. You start the timer, end the timer, and then boom, it goes right into the invoice. And the thing is, when they're sending out the invoices, that's your accounts receivable. When they get paid, that's your accounts payable. And all of a sudden, without you doing anything, you're keeping books. And you can look at any time at your dashboard and say, I made a profit, I'm making a profit, or I'm losing money. You can adjust it on the fly. Most entrepreneurs, I know certainly me, when I was doing this as a freelancer, you don't really know until tax time. Did I make money this year? How much did I make? With FreshBooks, there's no mysteries. You know everything. And that really means you can do business better. They're constantly improving FreshBooks, too. I think that's so cool. Time entries now are sorted chronologically on the invoice for you automatically. You can see receipt attachments when you view invoices in the iOS app. Employees can log into the FreshBooks mobile app for iOS so they can take care of business. You don't have to do it all. You can access FAQ articles with FreshBooks' new help widget. Just click on the blue question mark in the bottom right of your desktop and anything you need to know. The beauty of this is, look, you didn't get into business to learn double entry accounting. You did, that's not, you know, it wasn't anything I was interested in, unless you're, I guess if your business is a bookkeeping business. But even then, it's nice to have somebody doing the work for you. FreshBooks does it all without you having to know anything about accounting. Just in the process of your business, you get this hat. This is done for you. And man, you're going to love it. FreshBooks was in the, included this year in the Forbes Small Giants list of 2017 because they're not, you know, they're not a startup anymore, I guess, any more than I'm a startup. They've been around a long time, but they just get better and better. And every day, this seems like they've got a new feature on their dashboard. And the beauty part of this is if you are using FreshBooks to send those professional-looking invoices, it's easy for you. It's easier for your clients. They pay you faster, on average 11 days faster. So it's a win all around. You can try it free. You don't have to take my word for it. Try it right now at FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. You'll see why I fell in love with FreshBooks all those years ago. And I still love them. FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. Do me a favor where you, when they ask you, how did you hear about us? Just please tell them MacBreak Weekly sent you. MacBreak Weekly. That's FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. You can thank me later. I'm telling you, this is going to change your life. Make your business so much easier. FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. Now back to MacBreak Weekly. Thanks.
Thanks, Leo. Hope you're enjoying your vacation. If you're interested in what Leo's doing, you can follow him on Instagram. He will make you very jealous with his pictures. I'm Renee Ritchie. I am here with Andy Inatko from the Chicago Sun-Times and Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corps. And we are redissecting what Apple announced at their event. And Alex, I have a question for you. Apple really went all in on displays this year, like even more than they had DCI P3 before. They had Rec 2020, which I understand is like the next generation of color, wide gamut color support. But now they've got their first real HDR display. Previously, Samsung had HDR displays, but their color management was never great. And you had to manually manage profiles. And there's really not a lot of content for it. Apple is doing everything from the chipset, you know, supporting HEVC and HDR10 and Dolby Vision, all the way up to the display having a 1,000,000-to-1 contrast ratio to really show it. And I always knew that I liked HDR more than 4K, but I was really amazed with what you could do even on a small iPhone screen with HDR.
Yeah. I think that I think Apple had to do that when they did the update, because I think that they had been a little behind on the 4K process. Not really behind. I mean, there's really not that much people are watching in 4K yet. But you know, a lot of our TVs are all 4K. Apple TV was like the last one to really go 4K. I think that there's a lot of things that they had to catch up on. If you're going to do it, you know, you're not going to do it again for another year. It's kind of time to just handle all of those things at the same time. The HDR is really is the distinguishing factor. I mean, when you really start to see a great show shot shot with HDR, and when we think about how shows are shot in HDR, a lot of times what's happening is that these a lot of stuff is shot in what's called log rather than linear, and so it's just a different way that it allows for a lot more data to be caught into it. Looks, when you actually look at a log file, it's very low contrast, and so when we put it back to linear, you know, we can actually grab onto a little bit more of that. And I think that's not exactly what we would think of as HDR most of the time. I know I have some technical friends that'll probably hate what I just said. but a lot of times that's the easiest way to get to something that has a wider gamut than what we would normally have in video. So a lot of times what you're seeing is that kind of conversion. But it is going to give you this wider gamut that you haven't seen before. And when you combine it with high resolution, with 4K, it is stunning. Like, we do a lot of even if we're streaming 720p or 1080p, a lot of times our video system, you know, is recording at 4K. And when you see the 4K itself, oftentimes, you know, it looks amazing, looks almost better than 3D sometimes, you know, like more 3D yep. than 3D. But when you start adding that higher gamut, you know, I actually don't have an HDR TV, but I have a friend that has one, and I've been over at her house watching shows, and it is amazing. And I think that, you know, as we go into higher frame rates, as we go into HDR, 4K, I was looking today. I was at IBC, which is the kind of the NAB of Europe for the last couple of days. And they actually, NHK has the 8K TVs. So just when you think that it was over, when you thought that 4K was over, it was it, There's 8K TVs. They're already there. You know, they're already looking at them. And I have to admit, the hard part is getting over, you know, a lot of the Japanese manufacturers like sharpening. They turn the sharpening up. And so I actually found it to be too sharp. So it was, you know, it was like, it was hard to watch. Maybe it was the content or whatever. But the 4K, I think, is going to be the right thing. And I think we're going to see 4K for probably the next, you know, probably the next 10 years is really where we're going to see 4K next 10 to 15 years. There's rumors that one of the Olympics is going to be, the next Olympics is definitely going to be 4K, but the Olympics after that may be an 8K, at least in some of the source files. But
they were explaining there's two different HDRs. There's HDR10, which is just sort of a spec, and then Dolby Vision, which does frame by frame and gives you sort of targets to hit. I don't know if I'm explaining that right.
Yeah, Dolby, you know, the Dolby Vision is definitely, I think, a much better solution. It's just it's not as adopted as, you know, as some of the other formats because it's harder. Turns out that when it's harder, people are like, oh, that's really hard. You know, but it is, I think Dolby has really gone, you know, it's really interesting how they've moved from being known as audio to really spending a lot of time thinking really hard about everything from, you know, VR to HDR to, you know, they're really not, you know, they're really looking at total media science. You know, if you're feeling it or watching it, you know, I can imagine somewhere down the road it's going to be like Dolby smell. You know, like it's like it really smells like I'm there, and I know that they're using Dolby smell for this. Like
Dolby tactile. You
know? Yeah, Dolby tactile. That this feels like the Adobe. Yeah, not Adobe, but Dolby. This feels like the Dolby effect. So so it's good, and I think that. You know, the big thing for Apple going all the way in, what's good for us as consumers is that of course helps drive the market. You know, so now we're going to get, I think we're going to see a lot of people just assuming that I wouldn't buy a new TV now that wasn't HDR. Like I have a Vizio that's a year and a half old or whatever but I wouldn't buy another one that isn't 4K, doesn't do HDR. That'd be absurd. You know, so and that what that means for you if you are going to buy that, it means what's great for you is that this Christmas it's going to be cheap, and especially on December 25th to January 2nd, you're probably going to be able to get a 70-inch non-HDR for like $600. You know that's kind of what's coming because you know all these manufacturers that had HDR, and it's not what's interesting is not because Apple has a majority position because they don't. Roku has the majority position. There's other, you know, Amazon's got better penetration, but Apple has this kind of the thought leadership that when they say this is where we're going, it devalues everything that isn't going that way or isn't as much. It doesn't devalue the stuff that's more, but there isn't that much more than what they announced. But
people who have seen iTunes 4K with HDR say that Apple did a really good job, like encoding it. It looks really really good, even compared to some of the other HDR out there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I think that you may have to get back to a point where people start thinking about people who are using Wi-Fi for their Apple TVs may want to get that Ethernet out and figure out how they're going to get it over there, because I think that there's those UHDs are going to be big.
You know, so no more USB, but now you have gigabit Ethernet.
yeah, you need a good Ethernet. I'm going to guess that you're going to need a good Ethernet connection to watch those, or at least let them buffer for a little while to pick up.
Yeah, and display.
I saw Jessica Jones' intro, Andy, and it was like night and day, because previously when I saw it on my regular TV, it looked sort of muddy and washed out, but when I saw it in HDR, the yellows and the reds, it was like a feast for my eyes. I was amazed at the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I've had all kinds of closed room demos of new screens for the past like 5 or 10 years, and there's always hey, now it's HD, and here's the Parisian street scene, and now hey, here's 4K, and here's a new Parisian street scene where now you can see what kind of sunglasses people are wearing, and that's fine, but it's the HDR demos that really blew me away. They're seeing the sort of detail that I typically would only see on like a $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 screen. And I'd ask, well, how much is, what's the price point of this going to be when you ship it next year? And they're saying, no, it's going to be sort of a midline priced $1,500 screen. And before long, the what makes screen technology unique is that there really is no good, better, the good, better, best sales technique isn't quite so dramatic. At some point, the 4K HDR screen stopped being the thing that, oh, your person who has a who turned the kids' room into a home theater 2 years ago has, and it becomes something where it would be a lot more trouble to find a TV within your price range that does not have 4K and yep. HDR. And we're going to see that starting this year and next year. It really is going to be just like a standard HD set where you just can't find 720p anymore. It's everything because every single manufacturing line is now set up to create 4K screens and not just regular HD screens. And soon enough, every manufacturing line is set up to sell HDR as opposed to anything else. And you're just essentially going to get that stuff for free. And even this year, if you are, I've accidentally being a frugal bastard have played this exactly right, because in my living room I have a 1080 HD screen that I bought something like 7 or 8 years ago, and it works perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that the back illumination, I'm getting that sort of like black halo, that like dark halo around the edges of the screen, where if I'm watching Star Wars, it's like an Instagram vignette filter I can see around it. So I keep telling myself that, okay, well, I guess that's becoming more and more annoying, and I should probably replace that, shouldn't I? And then thinking, oh, but it still works fine. It's just a little thing. But now that I've, again, put it off for an extra couple of years, it's going to be worth it to upgrade to 4K and HDR, whereas upgrading to just 4K would have been nice, but not great. So you'll see
some great difference. I think that one of the parts of this announcement that made as much of a difference as Apple saying, oh, we're doing 4K, was the deal that they struck that all of us who have our HD content are automatically going to get Ultra HD, because what that's going to do is put a huge demand on getting the new Apple TV and a huge demand on getting new TVs. Because, you know, it's not something that, like, you know, I have a lot of movies. I don't know exactly how many, but it's hundreds of movies on Apple TV that now are automatic, you know. This is the first time I think I can remember when we went from one format to another, whether it was cassettes, you know, and albums to CDs or CDs and DVDs and DVDs to Blu-ray, and where I didn't have to go buy all my favorite movies again, you know. And so I think that is, you know, I don't have to buy The Matrix one more time, you know, because I had it on DVD. right, exactly. So anyway, yeah. But I think that is a. I think that's going to be a huge bump for the whole industry, you know, for 4K production for now. And most of the folks that we, you know, Netflix and Amazon and all of these folks, that has been a requirement, you know, since they started creating the content, you know, it's all been 4K, so that stuff is going to be, you know, continue to be, you just give them somewhere to go.
And I like that they're doing it across their line, because once you see it, like they mentioned that with the True Tone, is once you see True Tone, it's hard to go back. The other screens sort of look blue. And seeing the combination on iPhone 10 was especially interesting, because you've got so much going on. Apple's doing internal things to make sure that OLED white looks white, because when the media type changes, if you've ever done manual management of color profiles on other devices, you can sometimes have to recalibrate it for photos as opposed to web pages as opposed to other stuff. But they're doing a lot of that internally, and then they're also matching the environment with True Tone, so you get this sort of, it's hard to photograph because sometimes the camera does not pick up what your eye is picking up, but it looks like white. It looks like a piece of white paper and not an overly cool sort of bluish display that you'd think you'd get. And all of that going on at the same time, like managing the OLED process, managing the internal color. So developers, for example, they don't have to make different color profiles for their app. You talked to Sebastian DeWitt, formerly of Apple and DoubleTwist, about how hard it was to just get his app to look even passingly good on 8 or 9 different display technologies with different kinds of subpixels. And he had to invent his own anti-aliasing at one point. Just getting that for free. So you deploy an app on an iPhone 10 or you deploy it on an iPhone 8. And it just looks great, Andy. And I think that is the sort of heavy lifting that Apple had to deliver for this.
Yeah. It's all in all, the next wave of iPads is going to be just even greater, both with iOS 11, which I just finished installing before the commercial, and also this display technology. It really is going to become much more than something that can possibly replace your laptop for some people, for some circumstances. It, for a lot of people, it's going to be the preferred way to watch a movie, and also the preferred way to get things done, because it really is the integration, just like you said, of so many little technical flares, and the display being not the least of it.
Yeah, and you have but it's the same as previously. Like, I always think that at some level, Apple's ID department, their industrial design department, is trolling us. Like, for example, they'll have Touch ID on the iPhone, but not the iPad. So you sit there with your finger on it for 5 minutes and wondering why it doesn't open. And then they move the power button on the iPhone, but not the iPad. So you're holding down the volume button on the iPad, wondering why you're not going into sleep mode, or you're not turning off the screen. And now they have Face ID on one and Touch ID on another. But not only that, they have like these different gestures on one, and now you have ProMotion on the iPad, Andy, but you don't have it on the iPhone. You have True Tone on both of them now, but I want to see ProMotion. It's just, I never get everything on one device.
You know, I think that we're going to have to really challenge Apple now, because if there was ever a Face ID on the phone is really, really nice, but the iMac is screaming for Face ID, something where you sit down in front of something and you've got plenty of, you don't have to put a notch in the screen in order to put that apparatus. And so I think that if the next iMac, I mean, the next regular consumer iMac does not have Face ID, I think that that is the official, it's done. Apple's, the Mac is, the Mac is, the fuse has been lit. We just don't know how long until it reaches the barrels
of. What if it has a notch, though? Like, what if it's edge-to-edge iMac with a notch?
You know, if Apple is fickle sometimes, and sometimes they hold a grudge. I wouldn't put it past them to, on the next iMac, we'll have a notch, but no Face ID. It'll just be a notch just to mess with us.
Yeah.
I realized when you were talking about that, I was like, I don't remember the last time I logged into my iMac, because I have a watch, you know, like, you know, as I just walk into the room and I'm just kind of, I walk up to it and it just kind of opens up. I realize I haven't thought about that for a long time. So it's, you know, I wouldn't
notice
it.
It's a race now. It's a race on my Touch Bar MacBook. It's a race to see if I hit the Touch ID sensor first or my watch unlocks it. And sometimes one wins, sometimes the other wins. But it's interesting that we have multiple vectors. There was a really good explanation. I forget who had it, whether it was Panzerino or Gruber, but they were asking Craig Federighi. One of my longstanding requests was to have multiple vectors for unlock. Like, I don't want Touch ID or passcode. I want both, because that way it's something, you know, it's multi-factor, something I know plus something I am. And he answered, well, you know, we've thought about that, but what happens when, for whatever reason, your thumbprint fails, like it gets derolled, your hands are wet, you burn yourself, something, and now you no longer have one of those factors. We'd have to enable an emergency mode, and then you'd have to have like a long password or something, and then suddenly you have to deal with three different tokens to get in. And so it's all stuff that I get thought about, and I confess I hadn't thought about it that deep. I just want things. I leave it at Apple to figure out the details. I just want them all. But it seems like, to Andy's point, this is the ideal solution for many things. And I know internally at Apple, it wasn't. We can't get Touch ID. What can we settle for? We think Face ID is better, and we're going to put it on this phone. And if it really is better, then I would expect to see it on an iMac, because once they can manufacture those true depth cameras at scale, I just want to have it everywhere. I don't want to ever think about it again.
Yeah, I don't have any inside information about what their thought process was, but if I had to bet, I would say that step one is, we got to get rid of that home button. We got to get rid of that bottom bezel. How can we do that? And if it's, well, we could do Face ID, but, you know, we would have to add this incredible 3D projector array and find a way to stick that on the screen. And we'd have to have some sort of, like, we have to add neural net capability built into the CPU so that it could do all the math to make it work. And someone said, no, we hate the idea of having a physical button taking up that much space so much that we would indeed prefer to perfect triangular wheel technology over round wheel technology to make this happen for us. But the other thing is that I think that it's kind of a misunderstanding that biometric security is about improving security. It isn't. It's almost always about improving convenience. It's a way to give you a way to get access to a device that is secure enough, but never going to be as secure as a good password. And so that's why in my coverage, I'm certainly more open and more forgiving of Face ID, particularly because, as we talked about in the show before, Touch ID has its own problems of convenience. And anybody who lives in the Northeast or Chicago, any place where it's cold and you like to wear, you need to wear gloves several months out of the year, that's one obvious problem that Face ID corrects. So I wouldn't be so keen on having biometrics stacked on top of a password. I like the idea that I can be in a situation where I can decide that I trust this specific environment enough to just rely on fingerprint ID, or even in the case of my home, I trust this environment enough to have my phone simply say, if you see this Wi-Fi base station and you can see these devices on the network, then don't even require any sort of unlocking whatsoever. Just keep the thing unlocked. But also when I'm traveling, now it has to go to for me, I actually have a password, not a PIN, and it's so many words long that it is legitimately a pain in the butt. it's like you have to decide, you really have to make that choice between convenience and security. I took my bike ride and went out to get a sandwich, and for some reason my Pixel phone decided that as I was stepping up to pay for it, that's when it decided that it wanted my password and not a biometric, not a fingerprint ID. And now I wish my password were only a 4-pin unlock code as it was last year. Why did I have to make like an 18-character thing that I have to type as people are giving me, with their sandwiches and their pizzas, they're giving me the stink eye behind me. I'm like, new phone. Sorry.
Steve Gibson to type it in for you.
Yeah. But that's exactly it. You have to decide, do you want convenience? Do you want security? I think the best solutions always give you the choice of situational choices of how you want to secure your phone.
Well, one thing that I really like, Alex, that I was asking for a while, is that I wish that Apple would demand Touch ID before they do Safari web fill or iCloud keychain fill. Because if there's someone in an emergency or just a friend who wants to use my phone, I don't want to give them all my credit cards and all my passwords just in case. And they're starting to do that a little bit with iOS 11, where in apps, if you want to use your banking app, you can fill it with your Safari credentials, but you need a Touch ID. But my understanding is that Face ID is so fast, they're going to let you do that everywhere so that you'll have like sort of secure iCloud keychain on every device, on everywhere now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I do think that the future of passwords is all going to be biometric, because it is so insecure to make us remember all these. You want to have a different password for everything that you put in. So that if something like the Equifax thing happens, they didn't have the same password that you had in six other things like your bank account because you thought that was important. All of those things are I think important. I've gotten to the point where I make these long ones. I have to admit that if I half the time if my biometric doesn't work, I can't remember what my password was. What did I do with that? The whole for me is really that, LastPass is on my, I don't let any browser touch my password. So LastPass has my passwords. And if I log in on a phone and I make a new password, it's like an extra step for me to figure out, put the password into the thing. And it's not as automatic as it is on my browzer. And so a lot of times I try to make sure that I'm on the browser to set my password so that I can, so that it's somewhere, that it actually exists. Cause a lot of times I'll be like a mad trying to get into something and I'll just reset my password and then, and then I'm stuck, and I remember it for that day. And then I don't remember what I did with that. And so the good news is I'm changing my password all the time because I'm constantly like, oh, I got to change my password again. And, cause I forgot it. And, but I think that, I do think one of Apple's big selling points, I think they're very focused on it, is the privacy, whether it's not being followed by cookies or whether it's being our biometric. I think that they're going to keep on tightening those things ever so slightly, and I think that they don't go so far to get more government attention than they need to. They're going to get some resistance at every level, but if they jumped all the way where they could go with it, I think people would be a lot more upset. But I think they're going to keep on turning that up because that's a differentiating factor, because they're not selling ads against you. They don't need that data, and they don't have any reason to help anybody who needs that data. That actually undermines everybody else's business plan.
They're not storing your face. So, people were worried that they were storing your face scan. They're not storing anybody's face scan.
Yeah, they don't want that. They don't want to score. They don't want to store your face. They want to do everything they can. I mean, I think that Apple users, I think a lot of times are, there's a certain level of them that are that don't want to be, that are buying this because they know that Apple doesn't have a vested interest in doing it. In fact, Apple's going to do everything they can to make sure that there's no way that they could even be subpoenaed to give you any of the data, And so, you know, I think that it's going to be, I am excited to see that they are at least letting the, you know, the depth map, the grayscale depth map out so that the people like me can have fun with it, or Snapchat or other things like that.
That's super interesting. So they take the face data and they convert it with a neural engine block on the chip, converts that into math that cannot be reconverted back into a face. And then it stores that and it compares that with machine learning because it understands that it changes over time with the registered face, and then we'll send an unlock, a yes or no token for the unlock. But they also give, like what you said, that a non-identifying depth map information to developers so they can do basically what Apple did with the emoji. Like I became a poop emoji at the show, and when I turned my head and when I spoke, and it does a really good job mirroring what you said. And it doesn't have to be the registered face, any face, it'll just sort of reflect the movement patterns and the expressions that I made, like grumpy faces and happy faces, and I shook my head, and that poop emoji, it stuck with me, like, oh, completely tracked on to what I was doing for a good long time. And that's available to every developer, Alex. You can make any app you want that does that. Sort of face tracking technology with ARKit.
To be honest with you, I the tracking was better than some of the face tracking we've done in the past, where we have all these cameras and we've got dots all over someone's face. And there's all stuff. I was like, you know, I could just get a headset and just put an iPhone 10, like hang it in front of me, and then put the mocap suit on, and that might be the. And when you think about I was looking at the iPhone 10 from a filmmaker's perspective, of a lot of times we're doing all these storyboards, and you know, I could imagine having, and there's apps that let you do 3D storyboards. So you can put a whole bunch of people in there, and I can just imagine being able to connect to that, like having my iPhone have all my storyboards, and I touch on someone's face and I just start talking. Like I just start, you know, expressing myself, and then it, you know, right, you know, that the script lines or whatever I wanted to say. I think we're going to end up with a whole bunch of these little like web cartoons that are done by creators, not by big studios, where, you know, the body doesn't move very much, but the head, you know, saying everything it wants to say and does everything it wants, you know, like, and it's putting all those out. And they're going to be funny little, you know, they're almost the next sketches of cartoons, where someone could literally pick up their iPhone and do a whole little 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute sketch about some situation. And it's that easy. Like it's just boom. And I don't think, you know, I'm the first person to think about that. I think there's going to be a lot of people who are making all kinds of apps that let us express ourselves and, you know, through hopefully not always doggy doo doo, but thing, you know, whether it's characters or, you know, and the scarier version of that, of course, is that deriving 3D models of people that we know, you know, not necessarily through the phone. You get a couple photos of a political figure or an actor, you can build a model of their face. And so I think that, and then you'd be able to, you know, shape form that pretty quickly. A lot of those technologies are very close to, or either close to the surface or on the surface at this point. So being able to get people to say funny things, whether it's Donald Trump or someone else, is probably less than a year away.
I didn't attribute it at the event because I didn't think the person would want me to, but there was someone who I'm guessing was a high-end videographer at the event, and he sort of mentioned to one of the Apple people in passing, he's like, "What?" To the effect of, why do you idiots still sell this as a phone? No one's going to pay $1,000 for a phone, but I would pay $1,500 to $2,000 for this just as a really awesome technological camera. And, you know, my guess is that, no, there's not that many people who would pay that much for a camera, but it did sort of switch around the way I was viewing this, is that it is a phone and we're used to it as a phone. But his point was that I can't get these features on cameras and I want them, and I think you're dumb to charge to sort of make it as a phone for people.
I think that's what
consultants are for. Those are the people who buy the iPhone for $1,000, write a $3,000 app for it, and then charge $2,000 for it in a custom case.
Well, and I think that, you know, I watch a lot of people say that people aren't going to spend $1,000, but I mean, a lot of people have been spending. I think Apple has a pretty good sense of the fact that a lot of people are spending very close to $1,000 for their phones as it is. You know, like, you know, like the, you know, if you look at the popularity of kind of a decked out 8 or 7 or 6, it's not really that big of a jump. So you get a fair idea of what that's going to be. And I think if Apple looks at the productivity of the iPhone 10 and how many they can actually make, I think that, you know, they're definitely in that zone of that they know that it can't make enough to fulfill the, you know, the demand probably for 6 months. Maybe
they want people to buy iPhone 8 to take pressure off iPhone 10 right now.
No, I think that they just, you know, they put the iPhone 8 out because I think if they only bid the 10, it would have been, oh, Apple has jumped the shark. It's $1,000 or whatever. But Apple said, okay, we're going to give you the same thing you've been buying before, but then we're going to give you another, you know, this is where we're going for the next round, and we're not going to be too contained about how much it costs, you know. And I think that I think they probably at $1,500 a phone, people would go crazy and the press would be nuts, but they'd still sell as many as they can buy. Because remember, a lot of people, if you're smart, shouldn't say this because now I'm gonna have to compete with everybody, but if you bought two iPhone 10s, which I think will probably be the max, right? You'll probably be able to get to buy, I think you'll get to buy two phones. Usually you get to buy two phones. You'll be able to sell one for the first, no, like literally for the first 3 months, no. You would be able to buy one and sell one for, and get, and basically get your iPhone 10 for free.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I never assume that Apple is going to send me review hardware like day and date when it ships. And I do want to I don't want to make sure I get zonked out if I have to buy one. So I will be up at 3 a.m. to buy one like as soon as it opens. And I was just reflecting on the fact that after the review is over, I might be able to make more money reselling the phone than I will from the column that the review that I write about this thing.
Oh, man. Yeah.
There was so much to like about things that weren't actually products in those announcements. I think that it would have been a huge mistake if Apple said that the top of the line phone is now going to be at least $200 more than what it's always been, where the minimum buy-in for the latest iPhone is always going to be $1,000 from now on. I think that's going to be problematic, particularly given that the trend is kind of to give you such a super phone for $1,000 that it really is more like a tablet, or to give you something that's practically as good as an iPhone 6 or an iPhone 7 for $400 or $500 on the Android side of things. So I think that would have been problematic, both as a marketing sort of thing and also as a battle for Apple's soul sort of thing. But at the same, it's worth noting that at the same time that Apple introduced $1,000 high-end phone, they also have kept pretty much the entire line intact, yeah, and knocked down the prices. So we finally have something that I've always wanted to see in Apple, where if you want to have, basically, if you want a $350 iPhone, you can buy a $350 iPhone, or you can buy a $450 iPhone, or a $500 or $600 iPhone, because you can still buy an iPhone 7, an iPhone 6, all the way down to, I think that iPhone 5S is still there,
iPhone,
or is that the iPhone SE? Thank you. I didn't know whether they kept that going. But so you're not necessarily getting 2017 quality components, but it's still an iPhone SE is still an exceptional phone and still compares exceptionally well with any Android phone that goes from between $150 and $400. So they kind of back their way into it. But if you're complaining about the prices of iPhones, all you're complaining about is that I'm complaining that I can't get the exact, the highest end device that Apple makes for the price that I want to pay for it. My problem with Apple pricing has always been, yes, but what if someone comes to you where they want a laptop, but they don't have $1,000 and say, well, sorry, go be poor someplace else. I'm glad that if someone wants an iPhone, they want the benefits of an iPhone. Pretty much if they have any practical amount of money to spend on a phone, except for the very lowest end of the price range, they can walk out with an iPhone that runs the latest version of the operating system.
All right. So on that note, I'm going to once again kick it to our vacationing leader in chief, Leo Laporte, because I have a feeling, I have just a strong hunch that he has another wonderful product and or service to tell us about.
Hey, we'll be back with more Mac Break Weekly in just a sec. Sorry to interrupt, guys, but first a word from Captera. This solved a huge problem for me. Every week on the radio show, people would call up as if I were some sort of business software guru and say things like, you know, I have a dog setting business, or I have a dentist's office and I need software to run it. And what do you recommend, Leo? I don't know. You know what I do now? I send them to Captera. CAPTERRA, Captera. .com. It's a free site. It's a directory of all the business software, all the business, 400 categories, thousands of programs, and best of all, they're all ranked, rated, and have real user reviews, hundreds of thousands of user reviews from people like you, you know, from people who actually use the software. So this is much better than asking Leo or Googling it. You know, you Google, you know, dog walking software, and you're going to find, you know, a bunch of stuff kind of random order. Captera makes it easy. You go to Captera.com. You can pick the category. Let's say, medical office, okay? A medical office. You tell it, you can narrow it down. You see already we've got hundreds of programs. You can narrow it down. Say, I only want to see 4-star reviews, and I want to see stuff that's not web-hosted, that's HIPAA compliant, lets me manage patients, and I have 10 docs or whatever. You know, you set the parameters, and then it'll narrow it, filter it down to just those apps that do what you need to do in the way you need to do it, and then you look at them, read the capsule reviews, look at the starred ratings, look at the reviews, and then say, let me look, I want to dig deeper on this one, this one, this one. You can make a comparison chart. It tells you everything you need to know and narrow it down to the right software for you. Whether you're a startup looking to keep better track of customers, a nonprofit hoping to have a record fundraising year, or a business that simply needs better payroll software, you can find the software you need at Captera. Captera's got you covered. And this is, I'm telling you, it's free. There are no follow-up emails. There are no phone calls. Free as in free. No cost, no obligation. It's a service from Captera that you've got to know about. Join the millions of people who use Captera every month. Yes, millions every month. And that's why they've got so many great reviews. It's so useful. Gets better all the time. Captera.com/MacBreak. Don't call the tech guy. Don't search the web. Go to Captera and find the software you need. Captera.com/MacBreak. Thanks, guys. On with MacBreak Weekly.
Thank you, Leo. I hope you're having a blast. I am here with Andy Anatko from the Chicago Sun-Times and with Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corps. And we are talking about just a little tiny slight bit of news from the last week or so. One of the things that fascinated me, Andy, is going into the show, Serenity Caldwell, a mutual friend, she was not convinced about the new Apple Watch. She wasn't sure what to make of it. We were discussing it and thinking, oh, I don't really want LTE on my watch. I'd much rather than always on display or something. And by the end of the show, that watch had eclipsed iPhone 10 in her eyes. And to her, it was the standout hit. And just, I don't know exactly what it was. I have to quiz her on this more deeply, but there was some combination of just the freedom that the LTE will allow or just Apple's continued focus on, like the added skating workouts. So that's huge for her. But what was your sense of Apple Watch is maturing as a product?
I think that I agree. I think it's as easily as important a piece of news as the iPhone 10. Even though the watch with LTE, it's an incremental thing. It's not going to be a breakthrough for many people, given that you're still going to have to, it's going to cost you $10 more a month. And a lot of people have to ask if it's going to be worth $10 a month. Apple, I haven't talked to Apple, my Apple people yet about it. But during the presentation, they didn't highlight, and now it allows you to use the Apple Watch completely divorced from your phone. Mm-hmm. Anytime they talked about the LTE, it was within the context of, now, when you go out for your run for half hour to maybe 82 minutes, you don't have to have your phone with you. And maybe if you go for a swim in the pool, you can have your iPhone back at the car and then come back to your phone in the car. They seem to be talking about it as a convenience feature so that you don't have to have your phone with you always, as opposed to something that lets you have a completely phone-free day. But it's such a great thing that it works just like the iPad, where if you want to, it seems to me like it's worth the extra $50 or $60 to have the LTE option in there, given that it doesn't really make the watch any bigger. The presence of the hardware doesn't drain the battery, and you can just as with the iPad, you can elect to have the hardware but not turn on the service, and just in several months in the future, if it turns out that LTE is something that works for you, then you can then activate the service. It's dazzling to me to see what to me is one of the biggest turnarounds that Apple has done in any one product. Mm-hmm. This was every single time with us from last year onward, they have totally reversed that really horrible introduction they did with this device, where it's like, I will never get over the, and look, I'm opening my garage door with my watch. Look, well, you can actually watch the garage door opening. And you're like, I've never been in a room where it was so easy to tell the difference between the actual press and like the people, between the Apple employees and the people who are either invited guests or press or analysts, because Apple people who are excited about like new stuff, yay, wow, that's great. And everyone else was like, huh? Why would I want to watch my garage door open with my watch? It really did underscore for me that To make a really great product, you do need great software, you do need great hardware, but the one thing you can't succeed without is a clear mission, a clear purpose, mm-hmm. something, a target that your team is working towards. And I think it was pretty obvious to me that with the Apple Watch team, they did not have a goal they were working towards until about a year and a half after release. It became clear that either through customer conversations or just internally, they decided that, okay, this is a fitness watch. This is a fitness device. It's a health device. And it has cool features that get notifications from your phone and stuff like that, and for navigation. But primarily, every feature, everything we do for this device is going to be to help out people who care about their health and care about their fitness. And just that level of focus has revolutionized. Even if you have my watch is a Series 1 watch, and really just this change in focus and the ways that the watchOS has been sharpened in the past few years, it made this watch so much better and so much more useful than even the waterproofness and the GPS and the LTE has. And just like with the phone, I think that it's wonderful that they have chosen to keep the Apple Watch Series 1 in the product line and mm-hmm. now cut the price all the way down to $250 as the minimum buy-in. And that puts it smack dab in the heart, in the zone of every other really good health and fitness smartwatch. Yep. So it's totally competitive with the Fitbit. It's totally competitive with a Garmin fitness watch. It's certainly not as cheap as $110 fitness band, which are they're also really, really nice. But it's no longer you're really competing with the right target price range. I think there are always going to be a lot of people who just can't figure out $400 for a watch, let alone a gadget watch. But when you say that here is for about the amount of money you would spend on a decent wristwatch of any stripe, how about you choose consider as one of your options this Apple Watch, which even if you don't care about its digital things, is still in and of itself a very cool watch. And this is I'm not like you, Renee. This is only my third band, including the one that came with it.
We'll get you there.
your Instagram will wear me down, I'm sure.
Yes.
But even just something as simple as now they have these that are not terribly expensive. They're $50, but they are for a user like me, this is exactly the band that I was hoping to see, because it's more formal than the plastic band. Mm-hmm. It also doesn't rip my big Russian it doesn't rip hairs out of my wrist every time I put it on and take it off. And so it looks nice, it looks dressier, but I still can't justify $500 for a stainless steel bracelet. And so it's these little things that have made this such a compelling thing. Really, the highest compliment I can pay the Apple Watch is that, remember that my phone is an Android phone. It can do jack squat with the Apple Watch, but I still choose to wear this just as a cool watch that I like to put on every day.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to me. Like, so this, the cellular thing, they're doing it the way they did GPS, and that is it really to conserve power, because I think it has just an hour of talk time on its own because it's got a tiny, tiny little battery still. And they did everything they could. They put the antennas around the screen. But the thing is, like, if it can use your iPhone, it will use your iPhone because that's much more power efficient. But for things exactly like what you said, when your iPhone just isn't there, when you're swimming, when you're out running, if you leave it in your car and you just want to buy something, or you just want to answer a text message, it can do all that now, and it'll do it as efficiently as possible. It'll wait to get updates, you know, when the network signal is really good, and it'll do as many updates as it can, and it'll do a conversation if it really has to. There's a couple caveats, Alex, and some of these affect us. Like, for example, in Canada, only one carrier has it at launch. There's only Bell support. There's no TELUS. There's no Rogers. But also, it doesn't roam. So if you get your Apple Watch with LTE set up in the U.S., once you leave the U.S., none of that functionality is going to work anymore because it can't reassign itself dynamically as you swap SIMs.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, obviously for me, that'll probably impact me a little bit more than a lot of other people. But I, you know, I think that's also why they're not selling it as a standalone device. It is something that is an add-on to what you're doing. I think that there are some power considerations that I bet you it does very gracefully switch over to, oh, I'm back near the watch. I'm just going to use the watch rather than use my antenna. And so I think that I bet you it doesn't. I'm sure we'll test it. One of us will test it very quickly. But I bet you it doesn't last very long if you just leave it on LTE. And my guess,
no.
My bet is 2 hours. and it's dead.
And if you're roaming, it's worse because it's not optimized.
Yeah, so I bet you it's a very short lifespan for a watch that's trying to do LTE. So I mean, given what it does to the phone, you know, when it can't find LTE or it's working hard. So, I mean, as soon as you turn off LTE on your phone, it'll last forever. You know, so,
yes.
So we know how it kind of affects that. So I think that, but I love it. I was at this video conference, and I walked up to the folks that make our intercom. You know, when you're doing live events, you know, your comm system is everything, like, you know, how you talk to everybody. And there's PLs and there's people and there's direct lines and there's, you know, all this stuff, and four wire and two wire, and ClearCom is the company we use for all of our comms. And I walked up and I was like, so when are we getting the ClearCom on our watch? Cause I was like, now I can put my little AirPods in and I can have my watch and I can just walk around and talk to people on comms. And their whole thing was battery. And of course, all of them said, we're going to talk to our boss. I think we really need to start testing it, which means we all have to get new watches. And they were very excited about the fact that a customer was actually asking. But I think that, you know, that I think that's going to be, there are so many really interesting things we're going to be able to do with it that, yeah. You know, I think, I'm just happy. I think that they really struck on something that is a pain point, which is that you go to the beach or you go to the pool and you don't want to jump in the pool and leave your phone in a public area. But you also don't want to not, you know, be able to connect and talk to people. And so I think the kind of examples that they had there were perfect.
Yeah, yeah. I really do hope that Apple does make the Apple Watch either multi-platform or something that is perfectly usable as a standalone device, because I really think that this is above of all the things that Apple makes, of all the pieces of hardware that Apple makes, it has the greatest potential to really help human lives by improving human lives, improving human health and extended human life. And to limit it just as an iPhone accessory really puts the brakes on the potential of this device. I don't think they would have to do a whole lot either. I mean, even just one of the things I found that, of course, because this doesn't connect to a phone, so I keep it in airplane mode. And if you keep this in airplane mode, you get like at least two days yeah. out of it, like 2.5 yeah. days. And so if I had the ability, even if they couldn't make it multi-platform, if I just had the ability that when I take it back home and turn on Wi-Fi and it sees my Mac, it can at least sync my health data to my Mac or to my iPad or something like that. There's so much they could do with this by making a standalone device and multi-platform device. And you just think about how the iPod or the iPhone would have been limited if you could only use it if you had to have a Mac in order to take advantage of it. I do think that that's where Apple's going with it. I think that the LTE is one step towards that. But if they really, what we've seen over the past couple of years really does prove that Apple has incredible amounts of faith and incredible hopes for the Apple Watch. And so if that is true, then I think that they're definitely going to try to make it multi-platform.
Or just you have your Apple Watch, you have your AirPods, and you have whatever the Apple monocle that you need to get yeah. an AR screen in front of you. And that's all you need to leave the house with anymore.
Yeah, that it really does. It does make all the reasons Apple had for getting rid of the iPods. I also own a pair of AirPods, and this plus AirPods, it really is a terrific music yeah. solution, particularly when they with a new update to watchOS lets me have like more than one playlist. That's going to be pretty cool when Apple Music comes to the watch as well. That's going to be okay. Maybe I wouldn't have spent necessarily $500 or $600 walking in and out of a store to have a replacement for an iPod that consists of a watch and AirPods. But okay, I had the watch anyway, and I was going to buy the AirPods anyway. And now I'm just realizing that if I want to walk around with my usual like cycling music and just not have to worry about taking up storage on my phone or taking up battery on my phone, this really is a great solution.
There are a couple of things. You mentioned Apple Music is coming later. Person-to-person Apple Pay is coming later. iMessage Sync is coming later. Also, that AirPower, that little pad they have that lets you charge one or two iPhones and up to a total of like an iPhone, AirPods with a case that's coming later, an inductive charging case that's coming later, and an Apple Watch all at once. That's coming, I think, next year. But it's interesting to see Apple sort of pushing. You know, they are announcing still ahead. We haven't seen the HomePod yet. We haven't seen the iMac Pro yet. But now we have other new products to look forward to as well. It's going to be such an expensive Christmas.
Yeah,
with the iMac Pro and with the speaker, I think that we're still yeah. kind of in the thick of it. And that's when, you know, I think that some of the stuff that I, that the kind of the coded stuff that you get from Tim Cook, you know, a year ago, he's like, we're really excited about what's coming up. And he stares at him. You know, like we're not, I know that you all think that it's over, but we're really excited about what we got. Because all of these products that we're looking at today, they didn't start working on them last spring. They started working on them 2 years ago. You know, and so when they're looking at what they're rolling out, you know, these are very long curves that they worked on for 2 years or 3 years or four
that
years.
That bionic chipset was 3 years in the making. They said the neural engine block was three years in the making.
Yeah, so you know, it's there's a, you know, I think that they're really hitting on all at this point. I think they're hitting from a product perspective on all cylinders, and it'll be interesting to see. You know, of course, I look down the path and I'm going, so I wonder what the new Mac Pro is going
to
look like.
You know, yeah, we haven't gotten to next year yet. The next Mac
I hate to be Debbie Downer here, but I want you to think about the genuine excitement in their eyes and in what they chose to talk about the iPhones, and the genuine excitement in which they just talked about the charger for the new iPhone and for the Apple Watch and everything. And I want you to compare it to everything they've said when they've announced new stuff about the Mac. And then let's pour ourselves a glass of something of something alcoholic, and then we can talk about whether or not Apple is really excited about the Mac or not.
Well, I think that bionic chip benches like a Mac.
I think that the thing that is interesting is the ecosystem that they have to support. So if you look at, you know, Apple is now, I mean, they're with their Pro, you can do some development in, you know, in VR, or the iMac and the iMac Pro, you'll be able to do some development in VR. I think that the problem they get into is because the Pro specifically fell behind. You watched Oculus move off of something that was originally developed on a Mac, moved to Windows. Now that's an ecosystem moving away from you. And I think that is the one part that Apple may or may not want to necessarily lose traction on. So I think the one argument that I think the iMac Pro may be all they need. But when you talk about being able to have the extendability to be able to do some of the stuff that you want, it's more than just losing a product line that maybe is 1% of your business. It's that product line is also being sold to the folks that are deciding what platform they're going to develop the next consumer market on, you know, and I think that's I think that's the only reason that they stay in it. I mean, you've got editors, you've got people, you've got a lot of creative professionals that you know, when you go into a press room, you don't see a lot of PCs, you know, so I think that, you know, that ecosystem is important for a lot of other reasons other than just pure direct sales to consumers.
Yeah, that's also important, but again, the message from WWDC is that we love the Mac. We think the Mac is a really important platform for developing software and content for iOS devices. They're not the fact that they went they spent a whole hunk of WWDC talking about their commitment to the Mac without once mentioning the Mac Mini. Woof. I mean, that's an omission of note. Whether it means that they now have no interest in making consumer grade Macs, or it means that they intend to replace the iMac with something that can complete the mission of a low cost entry level desktop headless Mac in a different form factor, like something like an Apple TV form factor that just has that just has USB 3 and an SSD built in and wireless, and that's it. Remains to be seen, but I'm just saying that I'm very, very concerned at this point.
You're not Debbie Downer, you're Andy Anxiety, and I feel it with you, Andy.
I'm Randy Realist. That's what Randy I am.
No, I mean, it's absolutely legitimate, especially now when you're on your iOS device high. There's all these people using Macs. They just don't have
I'll repeat that I think that Apple is going to – I think that they – not that they will, but they – you know, if I was Apple, if I was running the show, let me tell you, like I would – get to a point where I was comfortable with that iOS is really all I need, and I'd keep on merging these two things together, and then I would release OS 10 for free so that people can put it on. I'd say this is the spec. We only promise it's going to work on these computers, but if you want to put it on PCs, you can. And that would be like I've now left the house and I'm going to burn it to the ground. You know, it's because it's, you know, I think that would be the easiest way to burn most of the PC market to the ground is to just say we're going to let everybody use it. We don't need that for our revenue anymore.
And then the next day, you ship the iOS Mac on the Bionic chip.
Yeah. It's
just, no, have your Mac.
Like,
we're
when you decide that I don't need this house anymore, I've got, you know, maybe I'll, you know, and I'm gonna, you know, you can do your development on your iMac Pro, on your you know, iPad Pro, and you can do, you know, everything, or the iMac now ships with iOS or whatever that is. Like, we've decided that this is the new operating system. You just dump the other one out there and just say, oh, yeah, everybody can use that too. It's not connected to a chip, and watch the swirling insanity. Because there's so many people that would love to have a Mac on their super powerful 4 GPU, you know, PCs.
On their quantum computers. On that note, I'm going to kick it to Leo one more time, and I'm going to come back and ruthlessly interrogate both Andy and Alex on their picks of the week. Ruthlessly interrogate.
I will tell you Leo, nothing, Nazi pick? Swine.
I hate to interrupt again. I'm on a boat right now, floating up the river. But I wanted to tell you that I am confident that I have not lost my camera, my wallet, my keys, my luggage, because I track it all with the tracker. I love the tracker. I have I put on my keys now the tracker pixel. In fact, the other day, it kind of is embarrassing. I thought I lost my keys. I was wearing a Scotty vest, you know, and I has all those pockets. And I don't know if you've ever had this happen to you, but I actually lost my keys in my jacket because there's I've had it in the usual pockets that weren't there, and I was at a rock show. We were seeing a Led Zeppelin tribute band, and I'm looking at it, I said, oh, at least I lost my keys. Maybe I left them in the bar next door where we went for a drink before the show. So I went next door to the bar, and I asked the bartender, did you see any keys? No. I'm looking around, and then wait a minute, I have tracker. There's a tracker on the keys, of course. So I opened up my phone, I opened the tracker app. It said they're right here, but I said, well, I don't see them. So I pressed, there's a button on it. I love this. There's a button on the app. It makes the tracker a 90 decibel. Yeah, it sounds like this. And this is nice because this is the Pixel. So it's also lighting up, which is awesome. Okay, I was embarrassed, but no one saw my embarrassment. And I went back to the show and I didn't tell anybody. I had them all along. But that's awesome. Now, had I left them at the bar and gone home, I could then look at the map and it'd say on the tracker app, this is where you left your keys last time we saw them. This is it's a Bluetooth. It is not GPS in the dongle. It's just a little tiny thing. This is the world's smallest Bluetooth tracker. But it only works when your phone is nearby. Once your phone has gotten 100 feet away from the tracker device, thereabouts, 150 feet away, it's lost contact with it. But that's okay because Tracker has the world's largest crowd GPS network. Anybody with a Tracker software on their phone, when they walk by your keys, they ping you. You can see it if you turn on notifications. Like you lose something, you turn on the notifications. Say, let me know if anybody sees it. And you'll get these notifications. Oh, yeah, your keys. They were just seen in Madagascar or whatever. I love the separation alerts. So if I leave my phone behind, the tracker makes noise. If I leave my keys or whatever the tracker's attached to behind, the phone makes noise. If I can't find my phone, I press the button on the tracker. And then even if my phone is silenced, which it is, it's going to ring. I love this. The tracker. Never lose anything again. Put it on your pets. TheTracker.com. TheTracker.com with a promo code MacBreak. They've sold 5 million of these so far. And I love, you know, you could change the battery so you never have to worry about, you know, running out of battery. I can go on and on. Just go there and get some. 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's nothing to lose. No risk. TheTracker.com with the offer code MacBreak. Now back to MacBreak Weekly. I haven't lost them, have I? Where are you guys? Hello? Wait a minute. Let me press the tracker button. See if they're around here. Guys? Oh, there they are.
We're looking for a perimeter breach on Leo Laporte at this point. It's a good, can we find out exactly like where in Monaco he is at any one given point? I guess I'm gonna start. Yeah, I'm worried that if I do have one of those trackers, I worry that if I have too many of them, it will cause me to lose my ability to remember where I've put anything, just like GPS has caused me to lose like 25 years of map skills. So That's the only downside.
I just want that functionality everywhere. I want trackers on everything, Andy. That's gotten to the point where I can't even find the cap to my pen anymore, and I want to stick a tracker on it.
Well, I suppose that some. But that's when you know that the passive aggressiveness in the office, like break room fridge, has gone from curt notes up to, so why is your waste basket pinging, Debbie? Is it because that there is a piece of Tupperware that once held my daughter's bacon tofu salad? Aha!
No. So, all right. Well, so Andy, since we already have you on full swing, what is your pick of the week? What are you going to tantalize us with this week?
Oh, this is such a dangerous pick of the week. For some reason, Amazon is having a colossal and aggressively stupid sale on Marvel Comics trade paperbacks. These are collections of complete storylines and just like complete numbered runs of Marvel Comics. And we're talking about like books that normally cost $10, $15, $20 digitally going for $1.40, $2, $3. And unfortunately, this I have not been able to find like a portal that says that here's all the Marvel books we have on sale. But if you just do a search for Marvel Kindle, Kindle graphic novel, you will just get 400 pages, of which at least half of everything on that page will be something really, really good at phenomenally stupid prices. It's so hard to spend just a minute recommending stuff. Broadly speaking, if you do a search for a series called Marvel Masterworks, this is a series that they've been doing for a long, long time where they're just simply, they will start reprinting Fantastic Four from issue one forward. So you can get the classic 1960s stories, and they have them for Spider-Man, for the Hulk, for the Avengers. And they've been around long enough that a lot of these things aren't that old. But they also have the latest issues. Once they're about a year old, they start getting collected into these trades. And a few that I would recommend is a version of the Hulk called The Totally Awesome Hulk. it's a totally new take on the Incredible Hulk. With a younger person retaining his intellect and being a super genius. And it's so fun. It really reinvents the entire thing. Squirrel Girl, which is, yes, you heard me correctly, Squirrel Girl, which is just goofy, joyful, fun comics. Superior Spider-Man is one of my favorite recent runs on Spider-Man, with a really great premise where you'll roll your eyes at the basic idea that a supervillain takes control of Spider-Man's body and becomes Spider-Man. And no, it's more like a villain sort of has this fight with Peter Parker to take over his body, and in doing so learns everything about why this villain, he's never been the victim. He's just a jerk. He had a bad childhood, but everybody has had a bad childhood. And it sort of rests when he started this little campaign, he thought, well, I'm going to live again through the body of my enemy. Basically, he comes at the end of this having achieved his goal, but thinking, I am a total pile of crap. I'm not going to just take over his body. I'm going to be Spider-Man now, and I'm going to be an even better Spider-Man than Peter Parker ever was. I'll go on for 10, 20, 30 minutes if I keep going. But it really is worth your spending some time just scrolling through and looking for things, because for $1.40, for $2.30, for $3, this is the sort of pricing where you can just buy something that looks interesting and know that you will get 6 to 10 issues of something being a complete storyline. And even if you'll probably like it, and if you don't, you're out $1.40. That's not even a cup of coffee, for heaven's sake. So I think that it's going to be going on for a few days. So by the time you listen to this, it should be still going on. It's worth me telling you this right now, whether that's true or not, because I've been reading comics forever, and I don't want to tell you how much money I spent last night buying these things, both to fill out parts of my collection and also a lot of storylines that people have been recommending to me, but I haven't gotten around to. But for $1.40, I will buy it. It will be on my iPad, and I'll just, next time I have a flight or a long train ride, it'll be there for me to read.
There goes my iPad, my iPhone 10 money, Andy. Right out the door.
Yeah. that's why I bought the 128 gig iPad and not the 64 gig iPad.
Smart. What about you, Alex? Do you have something that is perhaps more expensive than a book?
I know you're really dependent on that. And so I've been, but it doesn't have to be. You can start off without spending any money, which is great. So there's a thing that I've been playing with for 25 years called photogrammetry. And photogrammetry is really the process of taking a bunch of photos and turning them into a 3D model. And this, I got to tell you, over the last two decades, has gotten to be from just downright painful to downright fun. And I think it's worth folks just giving it a shot because it's something you can do with your phone. Well, your phone and your Mac. You can't really do, I mean, you can do a little bit of it on your phone, but you need a Mac to have the most fun. So it's called PhotoScan. And so PhotoScan is it's a piece of software, and you don't want to get scared of it. It'll look kind of technical and have all this stuff, but literally you can take this app, go out and find a statue or find a building or something like that. Just take your iPhone out and just shoot a whole bunch of photos of it. Now, we can talk about how to take those photos and everything else. And actually, it's something that we're going to start doing in the Pixel Core membership again that we're launching sometime soon. It's tomorrow. I didn't quite finish one of the pages. So, but one of the things that you want to do is go out and take a bunch of from all the different sides of as high as you can, as low as you can. I mean, a great thing to test is like a fire hydrant because it's kind of the right thing to just kind of play with. Anyway, take all those photos. You just drag them in. Just drag them in and say, hey, go find a bunch of points. Go figure out where all these cameras were. So it finds a whole bunch of points. And then you say, yeah, why don't you build a what we call a dense point cloud? And boom, it does that. And they say, hey, why don't we turn that into some geometry? Turn that into polygons, and it'll do that for you. And there's not a lot to do other than find the drop down to do that, and you'll end up with this little model. And it's amazing how much data is in that little model. And I got to tell you, it was not always this easy. So, and then you can imagine, I have lost many nights and fingers and blood and everything else trying to get models that look like this out of photographs. And so what we're seeing right here is not, what you're seeing on the thing is not stuff that has been someone painstakingly modeled. They just took a bunch of photos and they said, go make me a model. And so, so I think that it's just something fun, and it's a great little pastime of mine. I walk around all the time and I go, I wonder what that would look like if I did a photo scan with it. And so I take a bunch of pictures with my iPhone or my, and I throw them together. I have a DXO that shoots slightly higher resolution, so that works well. If you've got a really high resolution camera, it's slower. And it does take a while. Like if you, just in case you're wondering, if you take 180 photos and you throw it in there of an object, it will take, a couple hours for it to get all this stuff done. But it's something you can do in the background. You just kind of throw it in, let your computer work on it all night, and you come in and see what it's like. Now, the great thing about it is they've got a really good kind of, what I would say, cocaine marketing for you. We used to call that cocaine marketing when I was in Sony. You had to get a couple hits before someone would be willing to buy a whole album. And so what you can do is you can download this thing and put it in demo mode, and you can just see what it does. You can take a bunch of photos. You see it. You can't save it, but you can see it. You can see how effective it was and what it does and everything else. And that's great. Do that for a little while. Don't ask for the demo code immediately. Just play with it in demo mode. Then you can go there and you can say, hey, give me the demo code, and they'll give you a 30-day pass. And now you can actually save models. And if you have something like Cinema 4D or some other, or Maya or something else, you can actually throw those in there. Then when you're done, if you decided that you're actually producing something and you think you could actually turn this into a business, you can get kind of their base version. And that base version is about $350 or something like that. And then, if you get really serious and you decide, I really want to be able to model from spheres, like I want to use my Theta or something bigger to create 3D models, or I want to be able to take build a geodetic network, from a drone, those kinds of pro things, then you start spending $3,500 on it, but you've turned it into a business. And so you don't have to do any of that first. And it's just, everybody listening should just, if you got a Mac and you got a phone, go download this thing. It's just fun. It's just like magic. Like you took a bunch of photos and now you have a 3D model, And anyway, it's there's a lot of good business reasons to know how to use it, but it is fun enough to do that it's just worth doodling with. And I can't wait to see if Andy decides to doodle with it, because Andy, I think you'll have a lot of fun with it. I'm looking for. I'm expecting 3D squirrels. It's kind of.
No, so anyway. I, I've, I've been looking at all kinds of apps like this that I will add yours to the list with great interest because I do want to. I've been planning an art heist for several years. There's a piece of sculpture that you might have heard me talk about once or twice that was once the most famous piece of sculpture in the world in 1893. And I've been trying to figure out way, and there are copies of it in lots of museums around the world. And I keep with photogrammetry and other things, there must be a way that with a phone or by getting access to a museum that will let me basically have full access to it in a back room somewhere, there must be a way that I can do photogrammetry, create a good 3D model that I will almost certainly have to fix up a little bit on the computer, but then make a 3D print. So instead of buying a reproduction of this made 100 years ago that would cost me $15,000 at auction, I can simply 3D print my own version of it. But it would give me great satisfaction to just go into the Metropolitan Museum of Art without any authority, without any permission, without breaking any rules, and essentially steal a piece of art simply by spending 10 minutes taking the right pictures around it. So I'm really interested in this.
Well, the crazy thing is that with not very much correction, you can make your model airtight. You know, so a lot of times you get all this stuff working, and you can, and once it's airtight, you can print it, right? And so that's the, you know, as soon as you can get rid of all the holes, and there's all kinds of little filters that will go in and find the holes and fill them in and so on and so forth. And so you really can, you know, go shoot something and then build, you know, build a 3D model of it or print it, you know, and it can be done over a weekend. Like you could shoot something on Saturday morning and have a model by the time you get up on Monday. You know, it's a brave new world. Anyway, it's really fun. It's worth playing with.
I did it with the Lincoln Memorial several years ago. It was like a 3-foot original bronze reproduction, but it was perfectly set up in the museum where it was about at eye level.
Right.
And with like 8 feet of nothing around it. So I could really take comprehensive pictures up, down, all around. And also the Lincoln Memorial, it's not like someone putting their hand above their head. So there's like a hole here and someone's wearing headphones. Right. So there's all this little detail there. And I wasn't even trying very hard. But when I got it home, threw it on the 3D printer. And my God, I've got the Lincoln Memorial now after only 4 hours of waiting. And yeah, that really does blow your mind that you can come home from a museum or not even like doing photogrammetry at the Smithsonian. They're making 3D models of so much of their sculpture and so many of their artifacts. Then you can simply download this thing and print out your own copy of it. So imagine again an art heist where it's like that bust would make such a statement in my foyer. And then instead of simply like instead of sticking in your laptop bag and perhaps going to jail for a long time, you simply download a file or collect data and then spend a long time having to restart your 3D prints because you're not very good at making 3D prints. Well,
and the other thing is that you start shooting this stuff and there's companies called Shapeways that will print, will print this stuff out of metal, you know, like not a little printer. And so when you started thinking about if you want to have, you know, the Lincoln Memorial hanging on a little bracelet, you could do that too. Yep. You know, like you just upload it, you know, you build your little model and you upload it and you say, I want to make this out of, you know, metal. I'm always like, every time I see their stuff, I'm like,
exactly. Both the Jay Leno's Garage and Tested.com, their YouTube channels, they have really great stuff where they will show you, they will model or something either just from scratch in 3D or they'll use photogrammetry to capture something, do a 3D print of it. And then like with Jay Leno's Garage, they've got like an engine block from a 1903 whatever that's cracked and useless, but they managed to make it out of plastic. They've bolted it onto the rest of the engine, make sure it fits, and then they simply send this to a foundry that can make a traditional mold out of it and then pour actual steel into it. So yeah, the ability to I'm really fascinated by this. I've made so many attempts before with this piece of sculpture. I haven't found the right copy of the sculpture in the right environment. I did talk to a museum that would be more than happy to. They have a copy of it that's not on display, but they're certainly willing to let me go into the research area. They'll set it up for me. And I can have a few hours with lights and everything, doing whatever I want with it, as long as I don't touch it. But it is amazing.
When are we
doing
that?
Yeah.
unfortunately, there was a funny story. They reported, and they were in Boston. They reported what might have been an art theft of like an important $200,000+ piece of art in their collection. And then it turned out that it wasn't. It was never stolen. It was just like they misplaced it in a desk or someplace, which led a whole bunch of people to change jobs and then them to say, tell you what, we're closing down the entire art department. We're barricading it until we empty out every closet, every drawer, every shelf, create a catalog of everything in a new system. So unfortunately, that happened like a month after I got this permission and before I'd managed to set up a day at a time.
The photogrammetry is great, but I have even better tools. You know, if you get open access to something, the photogrammetry is stealing stuff. But if you have the access, there's a thing called a laser scan.
Like a Faro unit. Yeah, there's
a ZNF. Like the Faro unit. The Faro unit is kind of like the Chevette and the ZNF.
We're gonna talk a little bit about this later. I know we should wrap up. I know we're very late. I'm sorry. But there's one of the most beautiful piece. My favorite piece of public sculpture in the world is in Boston. It's in a corner, far off corner of the Public Garden. It's a statue of an angel by Daniel Chester French, who also did the Lincoln Memorial. And it's just the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. And it's special, precious, because it's not in a place of the public garden where if you're taking a regular walk, you'll probably encounter it. And also, it used to be very poorly tended, where there's so many, the landscaping around it kind of made it into this sort of like private garden that was very hard to see. But recently, they totally re-landscaped it so you can see it in 360, which suddenly got me thinking, I could fly a drone around it and get the 3D photogrammetry, because I was so in love with that statue that when I had a once in a lifetime opportunity, the artist's estate was being renovated, and for a limited amount of time, artifacts from the sculptor's studio were being displayed in this tiny museum in Concord, so that the maquette for it, which would have been my only opportunity to get up, down, all around it. And so I was, it's pretty exciting, the idea that you can come home not with just a watercolor painting that you made or photograph, but I've got 3D data. I can have one of these in my room if I want. I can make a Christmas ornament out of it. I can make a cake topper out of this if I'd like, out of sponge sugar. All I got to do is take enough pictures.
There's something about laser scanning. I don't own a laser scanner, but I have a good friend who has a lot of them. And there's something about when you have access to a laser scanner, you just want to scan everything. You're like, I think I got a new job. And you talk to the clients. They're like, do you mind if I bring something with me? And they're like,
kids stop moving long enough, Alex. Is that a real concern if the kids stop moving for long enough?
Yeah, exactly. The kids have learned.
Keep moving or Dad will scan us. Keep moving.
My kids have been scanned a few times.
I'm going to wrap us up quickly with just, I only have a few things to say about my pick of the week, and it is the LG, I'm going to get this right, C6P, and that is LG's current generation mid-range OLED DCI-P3 HDR panel. I picked one of these up earlier this week in preparation for the Apple TV 4K launch, and there's not a lot of content for it yet, but I did set it up. It runs WebOS, which is always near and dear to my heart, and it has built-in Netflix, so even absent the Apple TV box, I can still watch 4K HDR Netflix, and it looks stunning. There is 4K content, lots of 4K content. HDR content is mostly the Marvel stuff still, the Netflix and Marvel stuff, some Amazon Prime stuff, but you can see reds, you can see yellows. The DCI-P3 is real. If you have an iPhone with DCI-P3, it's so much more colorful. And the HDR, even in murky shows like the Marvel Netflix shows tend to be, you can just see so much more detail in the highlights, in the shadows. And even regular TV, regular upscale TV, you watch the end of Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and you watch the celebration at the end, the funeral at the end. And it's so beautiful because all the colors are just popping out of your eyes. So it is expensive. If like me, your job entails you no life where you can actually go out and spend money on things like vacations and other things that normal people buy, I imagine, you might have enough money squirreled away for this. But like Alex mentioned before the show, now that this stuff is going primetime, it's going mass market, it's hard to make OLED panels. So Samsung and other manufacturers are doing QLED, which is quantum dot, which isn't the same, but you will be able to get more HDR and you'll certainly be able to get more 4K come this holiday season. And if you do want to take the plunge, I spoke to a lot of people in the industry and a lot of people who really know their panels, and this is the affordable option. You don't have to go to the 10K panel, $10,000 panel, I mean, and you don't have to go to the dirt cheap panel, but if you want a good middle ground, I've been using it for 3-4 days and my eyes will just, I can never unsee it. It's just really, really gorgeous television. So I spent several Alexes there, Alex. Couldn't help myself.
Very nice. I am jealous. That's all I can say. I'm officially jealous.
I saw people when I was at the store, there were people buying, like, this is in Montreal. I saw people buying 2 or 3 of them. So I don't know what they're doing with all those panels, but somebody's obviously enjoying the sales.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us. I know I'm just a pale shade of a fully rendered 3D Leo Laporte, but I did try to soldier on for the good of humanity and the MacBreak Weekly audience. I want to thank Alex Lindsay for joining us from the Pixel Core. Alex, where are you going? Where are you going to be? And how can people follow you?
I'm in Brussels. I'll be in Berlin by the weekend. There's a little shindig there. And so I'm going to be working there. And then I am be back in the United States. But the best thing to do right now is I've been doing so much work. I haven't finished the little bit that I have to do for the membership. But if people are interested in the Pixel Core, you know, the stuff we talked about, photogrammetry and LiDAR, and then also live streaming and video production, all that stuff. We're going to be this week, I promise. I said last week, but I'm like, literally, we were testing all the e-commerce to make sure it all worked. But sign up to the interest list. We're going to send out a little coupon for that because the interest list tells me whether I've worked with you before, or whether you listened to one of the shows. So sign up to the interest list for the membership, and we'll be sending that out in the next by Friday. They'll be coming out in little bits, as we slowly test all the e-commerce, make sure that everyone can actually join. But we're going to be, you know, it's just going to be a big fun fest of computer graphics and videos. So hopefully some people listening might find that interesting. Anyway, that's it. And
Alex Lindsay on Twitter.
Yes, Alex Lindsay on Twitter.
All the time. Andy Anatko, what are you up to? Many podcasts, many columns.
Many podcasts, many columns. I'm still doing my coverage of last week. You know, you know me. I'm less the I'm less the person who needs to get the breaking news out that same day. I'd much rather, you know, put on my fake beard so I have something to stroke while I puff on my fake pipe and consider and muse about things. So that's starting to be published on the Sun-Times site this week. As usual, spell my last name to see cool stuff on Twitter, including a lot of recommendations of comic books to buy during the Marvel sale. I'm also Anatko on Instagram. Got my material Google podcast. Google is being very mean to a lot of people. So if you don't like, if you're anti-Google, it's becoming a very, very good. It's becoming a very, very fun podcast for people who hate Google, because there's a lot of stories about Google doing bad stuff that we also like to talk about there. And that's on Relay.fm.
Awesome. And I want to thank you, the awesome audience, the awesome chat room, everybody for watching us. I'm not sure if Leo is back next week or the week after, but he is returning. He did not abandon us. He will be back. The show will go to him. It'll be back in Leo's capable hands. But I want to thank you guys for joining us. And that's it. Mac Break Weekly is over.
Get back to work, you gold bricks.
Get back to work, you gold bricks. That's right.
Mac Break Weekly. What are you doing? Still here.
Why are you here?